Welcome to the Black Sparrow Media Internet Broadcast Network.
South Carter's Conference number 96140. Connection established.
No animals were harmed in the making of this podcast.
This car's server is supplied by the Great Lakes Reflector System, provided by KB8ZGL. Information regarding our HF operation may be found at www.southcars.com and for our digital operation at www.voip.southcars.com. Your net control station for this session is KB9RRN. My name is Dennis. I'm located near the city of Greenwood, Indiana. This is the Thursday night thematic open forum, or TNT for short. Now, let me advise all stations connected that this net might be recorded for future presentation on our website as a podcast. All stations participating will be a part of that recording. For tonight's program, we've got a kind of a special anniversary net lined up. Tonight we're discussing Apollo 13. Known as NASA's most successful failure, was made famous by a 1995 movie starring Tom Hanks as Jim Lovell, but was also featured in a book written by Jim Lovell, co-authored by Jeffrey Kluger, called Lost Moon, which details the trials and tribulations of the Apollo 13 mission. So that's what we're discussing tonight. Okay. For those that may not know, the Apollo 13 mission was scheduled to be the third manned landing on the moon, following Apollo 11 and Apollo 12. Obviously, 11, which was the first manned lunar landing. Apollo 12 followed it up immediately, shortly thereafter, in late 1969. In 1970, NASA was ready to try something a little more challenging. Apollo 13 was destined to land in the Frimora Highlands, whereas Apollos 11 and 12 had landed in relatively flat, tame, and fairly boring areas of the moon. 13 was scheduled to go into some little bit rougher territory, as it were. I'm sure as most, or if all of you know, the Lucky 13, the number, the supposedly unlucky number, was true in that approximately the second or third day into the mission, I pulled my reference material to look exactly when it happened, but the mission was befallen by an explosion in an oxygen tank on board, and things would never be the same after that. The craft was launched 42 years ago, April 11th, 1970, at 13:13 Central Standard Time. That's a numerical oddity in itself. The flight itself was commanded by James Lovell, with John, or Jack, as he went by, Swaggart, as a command module pilot, who was a replacement. He was never scheduled to be on the original mission. And Fred W. Hayes was the lunar module pilot. The reason that Swaggart was a replacement is because the original command module pilot was thought to have contracted the measles and was scrubbed from the mission at the last minute. Just another unfortunate event in the long series of unfortunate events that befell the mission. One of the things I'd be interested to hear about is people's perspectives, where they were when this all went down. This was 13 years before my birth. So I'm kind of showing my age here. And it is interesting to note, just in general, as the Apollo program proceeded, even with the furious pace at which they worked to meet President Kennedy's goal of landing a man on the moon before the 1960s had ended, there were no loss of any astronauts, whether it was the Mercury, the Gemini, or the Apollo program in orbit. Unfortunately, the only loss was Grissom, White, and Chaffee on the pad, January 27th, 1967, the famous Apollo fire that I'm sure many have heard about that actually would kind of set the stage for what happened on Apollo 13, and no one even knew it at the time. I didn't catch it till it was too late. So, with that said, I won't take a quick standby here, see if anybody else has anything to add, or just check in and say hello.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dennis. Gordon here, KY6B. But I'll tell you, I didn't realize it was that long ago on Apollo 13. When you mentioned 42 years, you're absolutely correct. 1970, I happened to be moving my derriere from California to Wisconsin on a job opportunity that was going on up there, and when this thing took place, I watched it, listened to it, and tried to get all of the information that I could, and I followed it at that time pretty much step by step. But then when I realized that you were going to have this program tonight, I had to sit back and think about the Mercurys, the Geminis, and the Apollo program, and then the space shuttles. I didn't really remember whether the Apollo program was still coming down under parachute landing sequences, and I think it was. As I recall, and maybe you can comment on this, I think they put down somewhere in the Pacific on their entry, and I'm referring to 13.
Yes, they did. They did come down under parachutes. And matter of fact, the last one flew, I believe it was 1975 when they had a little bit warmer relations with Soviet Russia, and they did the Apollo Soyuz test project. And traditionally, all the American space capsules up to the end of the Apollo program were re-entered with an ablative heat shield and splashed down in the ocean, whereas the Russian craft, to this day even, with the Soyuz, still land out in Kazakhstan, and they land on the ground, even though they do come down under parachutes. But yes, the Apollos did make water splashdowns, and 13 did come down in the Pacific, as did a lot of the return lunar flights. So we'll break with you, Gordon. We'll go to Jordan, K9NZF.
Good evening, Dennis, and everybody else. I wanted to make the point that everybody can stop and think about what would have been different, what would have happened had they not had the wonderful communications that they had, even though they had blackouts in it without radio. Where would they have been? Would anything even been able to have been done? So it's another good proven point that radio communications is, you know, a necessity and things like that.
All righty, sir. Thank you for the check-in. And yeah, it is amazing considering that also too their computing power was much, 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 much less than the average laptop today. Much less than the laptop that I'm using right now to run this net. And we're talking whole computer rooms in all of NASA's resources. It was amazing they were able to accomplish what they accomplished. It was, and you know, the radio communications, I'm sure, were deep in the heart of the state of the art. Take a quick standby. If anybody else has anything to add or a point they want to bring up, come on in. KB9RRN with South Cars VOIP TNT open forum.
LBM.
Okay, WB4LBM. Good evening, Jim. Over to you.
Good evening. And I just going to bring up one thing that a lot may not know, but the mission would have never made it were it not for the TI-99 the TI-99 was the only computer, now in fact it still is, the only computer that would go 16 digits beyond the decimal. And so they have to have that when they're deciding just where they're going to be and when in space. So.
Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate you coming in and adding that. And that was something I may have read at some point, but if I did, I certainly forgot it. And that sounds like it was a Texas Instruments device by the model number. And it's just amazing how much things have changed since then. You could probably run their guidance on, like I said, like on the average laptop today, and not have a problem with it. But back then, that was definitely the bleeding edge. At this time, we'll discuss just some fun facts. It is interesting that the Apollo 13 and all the lunar Apollo missions went to the moon on board the largest rocket ever to fly, the Saturn V. Of course, that was the brainchild of Wernher von Braun, who was Hitler's rocketeer during the Second World War, and developed the V-1 and especially the V-2 at Peenemünde. Supposed to be the Nazi wonder weapons, and fortunately he was captured by the Americans and turned after the war and started working for us and put all his missile skills to a peaceful use. Also the explosion that caused the mission to change from one of discovery to one of survival was actually caused by a reworking of the Apollo electrical system following the fire. The switch for the heater or the fan in the oxygen tank that was aboard Apollo 13's service module was of an older design that had been built before the change in electrical systems from the original Apollo specifications. And all those were changed following the findings of the Thompson Committee, which investigated the Apollo 1 fire in 1967. Almost the entire Apollo spacecraft was reworked and redesigned, and as a result, some voltages in the electrical system were changed. Somehow, the oxygen tank that made it aboard Apollo 13 was equipped with a switch to stir the cryogenic material, which is a super cooled state, kind of like a slush, had to be stirred in order to keep it from settling unevenly in the tank. When that was stirred with the switch, or the fan and the heater that accompanied were run off the switch, switch couldn't handle the voltage, and as a result, locked in the switch closed position, it actually fused. And that caused the heater to run for an extended period of time. The tank pressure rose, and the tank blew up. And it was all because the switch hadn't been changed from the pre-revision specs that occurred after the Apollo 1 fire in 1967. Now let's get down to the actual explosion itself. And as with all good things, we do our research on Wikipedia. And we'll quote their article here because it was actually pretty straight and to the point about the explosion. Quoting now, en route to the moon, approximately 200,000 miles from Earth. That's the moon is approximately 250,000 miles from Earth. So this was approximately 50,000 miles, give or take, from the moon. Mission Control, which, of course, was Mission Operations Control Center in Houston, Texas, asked Command Module Pilot Swaggart to turn on the hydrogen and oxygen tank stirring fans, which were designed to de-stratify, or stir up, the cryogenic contents and increase the accuracy of their quantity readings. As I said earlier, if those cryo tanks weren't stirred periodically, they would the material would settle unevenly and caused the instrumentation in the spacecraft to read inaccurately. approximately 93 seconds later, just under 56 hours since launch, the astronauts heard a loud bang accompanied by fluctuations in electrical power and firing of attitude control thrusters. And those thrusters are the little guys that ride on the side of the spacecraft and cause it to change attitude, pitch, and roll, yaw, and so forth. And the crew initially thought that a meteoroid might have struck the lunar module. And instead of a meteoroid striking the lunar module, the number two oxygen tank, which was one of two in the service module, which was the cylindrical-shaped bottom part that went right below the command module, had exploded. There was damaged Teflon insulation on the wires to the steering fan inside oxygen tank number two. And the damaged Teflon insulation, as I mentioned earlier, was caused by the switch and the circuitry that was not rated for the new voltage. It caused the wires to short-circuit, ignite the insulation, and the resulting fire rapidly increased pressure beyond the 1,000 pounds per square inch that the tank could handle, and the tank dome, or the top of the dome, failed. The fuel cell bay was filled with rapidly expanding gaseous oxygen and combustion products. And there you go. Fire and oxygen, even in the vacuum of space, is a bit of a problem. KB9RRN.
Sierra United, November, with a question. Was this all visible in mission control? Did they see exactly what had happened? Or was there communication? And maybe you'll go over this. Was there like a blackout so that they didn't know what was going on?
Well, Kathy, that's a good question. At that time, while there were scheduled television broadcasts from the spacecraft, there was no real-time streaming video. There was no real-time around-the-clock broadcast. There weren't any cameras on the outside of the spacecraft at that time for the translunar flight. So the only thing that could be seen in mission control immediately after the explosion occurred, of course, the telemetry, which was the voice and the telemetry and data communications, basically, from the spacecraft instrumentation to the ground, and the voice communications to Earth were lost for about 1.8, almost 2 seconds, and the until the system automatically corrected itself. The only indication that the flight controllers had on the ground that something had gone wrong was a large amount of nonsensical data coming across their consoles. And they were seeing things that they never should have seen in an actual manned spaceflight. And that was their first indication that there was a serious problem. Initially, the crew didn't know what happened, but as they began to put the pieces of the puzzle together, they began to realize that they had a serious problem with their cryogenic oxygen. So, Kathy, I hope that answered your question.
LBM.
Name Charlie Bravo.
Go to Jim first, WB4LBM, KB9RRN. Over to you, sir.
The first thing that Houston knew, of course, Houston could see that there was a problem. All the instrumentation was going crazy. But the first confirmation they had that there was a problem was the pilot came on, the commander. He came on the air, and he said, "Houston, we have a problem." go ahead.
All right, Jim. Now, that is a very very valid point you make. And, yes, that is true. Actually, Jack Swaggart mentioned something first. And due to the signal degradation, because the spacecraft was moving all over the place, and the high-gain antenna had problems keeping its focus, which it was self-adjusting, and it was meant to self-correct and keep pointed at the Earth, but as badly as the spacecraft was gyrating immediately after the explosion, they were having some loss and degradation of communications. Jack Swaggart mentioned at first that we've had a problem here, and then the CAPCOM and Mission Control in Houston asked him to say again, please, and that's where the line, "Houston, we've had a problem," and the famous words of Jim Lovell now that we all know pretty well, definitely popularized by the movie in 1995. But yes, that is a good point that you bring up. So, Jim, thanks a lot. Appreciate you being here tonight, and you're definitely adding some to the net. So, do appreciate it. We'll go next to George, KW4LCB. Over to you, sir.
Well, good evening, Dennis. KW4 Lima, Charlie Bravo. You got my mind on a search there, Dennis. I hear you mention the switches, you know, and then I just started wondering about you know, why, you know, did it get to that point? Seemed like there ought to have been some type of thermal type switch would shut that off, or maybe it was a manual switch, you know, stands to reason. When you thaw something to a liquid state, you'll maybe wrap a heat it to start with, and then once it reached its temperature, you would go into a warming type mode just to keep it workable there. So, you know, it seems to me there would have been a few more switches in line and other safeties, and, you know, that's where, that's the trip you sent me on tonight, my friend. KW4, leave my Charlie Bravo. Enjoyed it, Dennis. Great job.
KW4LCB, KB9RRN returning. Thanks, George. Yeah, that's definitely a good point. That's a reason why we all need to make sure we install safety systems, be it fuses or fusible links, what have you. Of course, the explanation I provided here in the net, I'm sure, is somewhat simplistic. But my understanding is that none of that hardware that was inside the cryogenic tank associated with the heater and the fan to stir the cryogenic material was rated for the for either the voltage or the amperage. It was not up to the electrical spec of the command module. And further, they believe that it was some of it was damaged when the rack containing the tanks had been dropped at some point while the service module was undergoing outfitting and assembly. So it was just a chain of errors which led to the ultimate explosion in the tank, and one could actually trace it all the way back to the Apollo 1 fire and the vast changes that were made to the spacecraft after that happened. So definitely a good point, sir, and you could probably do a whole net just on that subject. This is KB9RRN with the South Cars VOIP TNT Open Forum. We're discussing Apollo 13 tonight. And this time, 42 years ago, Apollo 13 was in flight on the way to the moon. And this disaster was just beginning to unfold. But I'm sure, as most know, it was called NASA's most successful failure because of their ability to recover from it and return all the crews safely back home without any injury. Definitely their finest hour, as some of the mission controllers would later go on to mention. And it is very interesting to watch the old archive news reports from back then. Like I mentioned at the beginning of the net, this was about 13 years before my time, and it's just amazing how far we've come as far as instantaneous communication. Now we've got the internet, and most of us have more computing power at our disposal than all of NASA and probably all the federal government had at their disposal at that time. And it's just amazing that they were able to do what they were able to do when they were able to do it. So, okay, continuing on now, I could go into the gory details of the explosion, but just suffice it to say that when that cryogenic oxygen tank exploded, it tore a lot of things up, caused fuel cells to fail, slammed the valve shut, and when the fuel cells couldn't operate, the service module and did not have the oxygen supply, nor did it have the ability to generate electricity and oxygen and drinkable water for the spacecraft. So basically from the time that the cryogenic tanks exploded, the mission was doomed. Now, let's go on to crew survival and their actual return from their translunar trajectory. Okay, now the damage that was caused in the service module, it made a safe return from a lunar landing impossible. As a matter of fact, the service module was damaged to the extent that they probably could not have even done LOI, which was lunar orbit insertion. Excuse me, it's been a long day. And that is the operation of putting the spacecraft into an orbit around the moon, something that was first done on Jim Lovell's first flight in Apollo spacecraft in 1968, Christmas of 1968, when he was the command module pilot of Apollo 8. But that never would have happened with Apollo 13 due to the severe damage to the surface module. It was at that point that the mission was aborted by the flight director, Gene Kranz, who was a character. He's a real man, but his character, played by Ed Harris, was made more famous perhaps than he already was in the 1995 movie Apollo 13. Now, the existing mission abort plans, which were drawn up in 1966, were looked at. The quickest method of aborting the mission was firing up the service propulsion system, or the main engine on the service module, which was used for such operations as putting the spacecraft in orbit around Earth, or in orbit around the Moon, or returning it to a trans-Earth trajectory after the lunar landing was completed. Unfortunately, the service propulsion system, the main engine on the service module, probably would not have worked due to the severe damage sustained by the spacecraft. And if it were to be done, the lunar module would have had to have been cut loose or jettisoned and disconnected and left to float into space. This was impossible due to the fact that the crew needed the lunar module to survive. In fact, they used it as what was referred to as a lifeboat. So NASA opted for the free return trajectory option, which involved the spacecraft going around the backside of the moon and using the lunar gravity to slingshot it around back to a trans-Earth course. Back to the actual return to Earth. Apollo 13 was required to enter a free return trajectory, which meant executing a few maneuvers using the descent stage engine on the lunar module, which was originally intended to guide the spacecraft to a safe landing, the lunar module portion, to a safe landing on the moon. As a matter of fact, as a side note, Neil Armstrong in the 1969 landing of Apollo 11 almost ran that descent engine out of fuel when he and Buzz Aldrin were attempting to make the first successful moon landing. So this is the engine they used to initiate their course corrections and put the spacecraft on that free return trajectory. Now, the engine was never intended to be run like this, and it was definitely quite a bit of ingenuity involved by the trench in Houston, which was responsible for navigating the spacecraft, the crew, and all the designers and the engineers that worked on these systems, and got them to operate in ways they were never intended to be used, and did it successfully. Due to limitations of power, with having only the lunar module batteries to run on, which were intended to support, at that time, two astronauts for approximately a day and a half of full power usage, and they were trying to support three astronauts for several days, there was not enough electrical power to have live TV broadcast, As a matter of fact, the TV commentators on the big three networks here in the States at that time used models and animated footage to make illustrations of what was happening. And as a matter of fact, low power levels, the spacecraft was operating basically on the bare bones of what was needed for the crew to survive and talk, even made the voice radio communications difficult. Now imagine that. Anybody that's tried to do EME, I'm sure knows that they need a lot of power and some high-gain antennas, and these guys were pretty limited on what they had on hand at that time.
I'm Charlie Bravo.
Hey, go ahead, George. Good time for me to take a quick break and let somebody else talk. KW4LCB, KB9RRN, over to you.
Yeah, buddy. Well, I was thinking along those lines there when you started to mention where they would have to change the trajectory to the opposite side of the moon for to grab that slingshot window there. And my thought along those lines as to just what kind of a signal, radio signal that is, they were throwing back to Earth, you know, which...
Well, thanks for that, George. Yeah, definitely some good points. I mean, it is amazing if you go and look back at the old archive pictures and footage from that time, some of the antenna arrays that NASA had to communicate with these spacecraft in deep space. And when you consider that this was before communication satellites, and especially it made a big difference when they were in Earth orbit, they had to have a series of ground stations and a lot of infrastructure on the ground just to get the voice communications and the data communications back to the mission operations control room in Houston. So it was definitely a challenge, and something that, you know, we could probably learn from as amateurs in our quest to communicate just what the minimum is that we need to be able to talk. So as I already mentioned, the lunar module was actually powered down to the lowest levels possible. The guidance system was shut down, and the lunar module actually used its backup. The abort guidance system was used for most of the coast back to Earth because it used less power and water. And people may wonder why water. Well, water was mixed with glycol, similar to what's in the radiator in your car, and used to cool the electronics on board. Even though it was freezing outside, those electronics generated a lot of heat, and if the coolant was not run through them, they would overheat and fail. And, of course, that required water, and water was a consumable, so the crew was rationing their water as well. One of the issues that came up during the coast back to Earth after going around the backside of the moon was the availability of lithium hydroxide canisters. Lithium hydroxide was used to scrub carbon dioxide, or CO, which is a gas that we all exhale. Very common here on Earth. Plants love it. They live on it. They convert it into oxygen. However, they were not so fortunate on Apollo 13 to have enough plants to take care of their carbon dioxide problem. They only had enough lithium hydroxide canisters for two astronauts for a day and a half of constant usage in the lunar module, which was its life expectancy as it went down to the surface of the moon, stayed there for a fixed period of time, and then came back up. And then it was jettisoned on a normal mission and just crash-landed on the lunar surface, and that was it. It was a disposable spacecraft. However, since they were using it as a lifeboat, the lithium hydroxide canisters that were used on the lunar module were round or cylindrical, and the cartridges on the command module were square. Now, some of you may remember this from the movie, and this really happened. The problem, obviously, came into how to put a square peg into a round hole to scrub the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere inside the spacecraft so it would be safe for the astronauts to breathe. The engineers on the ground came up with an ingenious method using only the supplies that the astronauts were known to have on board in building a field-fabricated adapter to channel the atmosphere of the spacecraft through a square canister from the command module, or as was used in the command module, through a hose and into the life support systems on the lunar module to scrub the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So definitely an extreme piece of ingenuity there, and something that had to be called up step by step by step by the capsule communicator in Houston, because got to remember, 1970 didn't have the capabilities we do now. Couldn't just take a picture of it and send it to them. We take so much of this stuff for granted now, and it wasn't that easy back then. The device I just discussed was called the Mailbox, was its nickname. And its job was to scrub the atmosphere in the command module, the nasty, filthy carbon dioxide, which was polluting the air. This was successful. That allowed the astronauts to survive long enough to make it to reentry. Another problem that they encountered was initiating a complete power-up on the fly of the command module. That was something intended that was never supposed to happen in flight. The command module was powered up on the ground well before the mission actually left the pad by technicians from NASA and North American Aerospace who built the command module. All the systems were checked out, and then it was ready to go and prepared for the flight, and it stayed powered up the entire course of the flight on a normal flight, and wasn't powered down again until after the spacecraft splashed down and was taken aboard whichever aircraft carrier rescued it or recovered it from the ocean after splashdown. Well, due to the power failure aboard Apollo 13, the command module had to be completely shut off. And during the course of the mission, they had to devise an on-the-fly power-up sequence in order to bring the spacecraft back online, yet stay within a predetermined number of amperes that were available from the batteries on board, because they did not have the fuel cells to create the electricity anymore. So it was definitely a bit hairy there as they prepared to make their reentry into the Earth's atmosphere. Continuing on, as Apollo 13 neared the Earth, the crew, they first jettisoned the service module. This both exposed the heat shield so they could actually re-enter, and pictures of the service module could be taken for later analysis. And only then could the crew actually see what had happened to the service module and the massive damage that was caused, even to the extent of possibly the heat shield, the engine bell, and the antenna system aboard the service module when the oxygen tank exploded. Lastly, the crew, after they had powered the command module back up and fell within the requirements dictated by the ground as far as how much power they had to play with, the crew was secured again in the command module and jettisoned the lunar module, leaving the command module, which was nicknamed the Odyssey, to begin the re-entry into the atmosphere. Now, one of the issues they encountered was during the re-entry on a lunar mission, it was accompanied by radio blackout due to ionization of the air around the command module. Think of the ionized layers of the atmosphere that we use to communicate on HF frequencies. This was exactly what happened around the command module, except for it was much more intense, and instead of allowing long-distance communication, it kept communications in. So while the spacecraft was re-entering, the crew was completely out of communications with mission control and vice versa. The possibility that the heat shield was damaged, as I already mentioned, from the oxygen tank rupture increased the tension of the blackout period, which took actually 33 seconds longer than normal And this was probably caused by a slight course correction that was not exactly perfect, but still managed to work, and the ship neither burned up nor skipped off the Earth's atmosphere during reentry, which was a concern of the mission control.
Gordon here, KY6V. I haven't seen anything in any of the write-ups. I wonder if you have. Did any one of the three of these gentlemen reach a point of questionable ability to perform because of the state that they were in? I'm not talking the frustration and the anxiety, the reduced oxygen, what they had to do to get the foul stuff out of the cabin and so on and so forth. Did any one of them reach a point where their judgment might have been impaired? Over.
Gordon, that's an excellent question. That's one that I cannot answer. I have never seen it anywhere in any of the write-ups or follow-up material either. Never seen it discussed on any television programs concerning the mission. My understanding, at least from the way the 1995 motion picture presented it, is that there may have been some slightly blurred vision and other minor effects, but I don't believe the CO2 ever caused an extreme problem with performance. However, the crew was operating on very, very little sleep, as well as Fred Hayes developed a urinary tract infection during the course of the mission, and was really compromised by the end of the mission, his ability to perform fully. But he soldiered through and managed to make it back. So that is definitely a good question, and one that probably would require extensive digging to find out if that was at all possible. And of course, anyone that's interested out there, the manned spaceflight archive that NASA has is absolutely outstanding, and there are literally hours and hours and hours of audio and video and high-resolution photographs available, technical documentation. Almost anything you could want is available through the NASA Historical Archive. So we're going to continue, wrap it up, and talk about the findings of the Apollo 13 Review Board, which was convened on April 21st. Of 1970. This is KB9RN. Okay, as I said, the Apollo 13 Review Board was convened on April 21st of 1970. It included several notables, including Neil Armstrong, the first man, an American, to walk on the moon. Upon their review, they found that the oxygen tank failure was caused actually by an unlikely chain of events. And they base this on detailed manufacturing records and logs that they kept. The tanks that stored the cryogenics, such as liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen, both of which they had aboard Apollo 13, required venting, good insulation, or both, so they wouldn't build excessive pressure due to vaporization of the cryogenic material. Obviously, the compressed material, it's cryogenic, it's compressed, it's cold, and as it warms up, it expands. So they either had to be vented or have excellent insulation. Now, the service module oxygen tanks were actually so well insulated with the Mylar and the other flavors of insulation that they had that they could actually sustain and contain the supercritical cryogenic hydrogen and oxygen for years. That's quite a bit of insulation, folks. Now, each oxygen tank held several hundred pounds of oxygen, which was used for breathable air and the production of electricity and water. The construction of the tank made internal inspection impossible. This was definitely a negative in terms of maintenance and repair. Now, the tank itself, the tank that exploded, contained several components that were relevant to the accident. There was a quantity sensor. There was a fan to stir the contents, which would cause more accurate measurements. There was a heater to vaporize the liquid oxygen. there was a thermostat to protect the heater, and there was a temperature sensor. There was also fill and drain valves and piping. Now, the heater and protection thermostat were originally designed for the command module's 28-volt DC bus. The specifications for the heater and thermostat were later changed to allow a 65-volt ground supply in order to pressurize the tanks more rapidly. This occurred after the 1967 Apollo 1 fire. Now, Beechcraft, the tank subcontractor, they didn't upgrade the thermostat to handle the higher voltage. So obviously, if you could trace the problem back and pin it on one company, it was Beechcraft. The temperature sensor couldn't read above the highest operational temperature of the heater, which was approximately 100 degrees Fahrenheit, or 38 degrees Celsius. Now, normally this wasn't a problem because the thermostat was designed to open 80 degrees Fahrenheit, or 27 degrees Celsius. The oxygen shelf that carried the oxygen tanks was originally installed in the Apollo 10 service module, but it was removed to fix a potential electromagnetic interference problem. And back to what I mentioned earlier about the drop, during removal, the shelf was accidentally dropped about 2 inches, 5 centimeters, because the retaining bolt had not been removed. The tank appeared to be undamaged, but a loosely fitting filling tube was apparently damaged, and photographs suggested the close-out cap on top of the tank may have been hit by the fuel cell shelf. The report of the Apollo 13 Review Board considers the probability of tank damage during this incident to be rather low. Now, after the tank was filled for ground testing, it could not be emptied through the normal drain line, so they could avoid delaying the mission by totally replacing the tank. The heater was connected to 65-volt ground power to boil off the oxygen. Should have taken a few days at thermostatic operating temperature, but when the thermostat opened, that 65-volt ground supply fused the contacts closed, and the heater remained powered. Now, when that heater remained powered, the temperature raised to an estimated 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The heater wasn't cycling on and off, as it wouldn't have been if the thermostat was functioning correctly, but nobody noticed it. The monitoring equipment could not read higher than 100 degrees Fahrenheit due to the sensor that could not read higher than that, and the gas itself evaporated in hours rather than days. And then the high temperatures melted the insulation on the wires and left them exposed, and when the tank was refilled with oxygen, it basically became a bomb waiting to go off. During the cryostir procedure, fan power passed the bare wires, which shorted, produced sparks, ignited the Teflon, and the rest is history. That caused the explosion. So folks, that pretty much wraps it up. We've discussed NASA's most successful failure tonight on the South Cars VOIP Open Forum. There's just so much more. I would recommend to anybody that is interested more in this, other than just watching the movie, because the movie was somewhat dramatized and there was actually quite a bit that it did not cover, is to check out the NASA Manned Spaceflight Historical Archives. You can find those by going to the NASA website at nasa.gov. You can also read the book. It was retitled Apollo 13 after the movie came out, but it was originally titled Lost Moon, and it was co-authored by Jeffrey Kluger, authored by Jim Lovell, who was the mission's commander. And that book is very thorough and in-depth, and it's just an amazing read. So anybody that would like to go and research into this further, definitely check those two sources. And of course, there's a lot of interesting information out there on the internet in relation to this particular topic. So K6SUN from KB9RNA.
So this has been South Cars, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. VOIP net schedules and general information may be found on the VOIP.southcars.com website. Your net control for this session has been KB9RRN, and I'm just ending the session. My call sign is Kilo 6 Sierra United November. His name was Dennis, and my name is Kathy. Saying 73. closing this BYP session. Thank you for your participation. I hope you enjoyed the program this evening. The net is now closed. Saying bye-bye for now.